dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This weekend, Americans once again celebrated the anniversary of the signing of the Declaration that announced a revolution based on the principles that, quote, all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. American reality has always fallen far short of that ideal, and our history can be viewed as an ongoing struggle to compel government to make good on the promise of the revolution. That struggle continues, and tonight on the program, we'll hear from several people with critical analysis of where we are, where we need to go, and how to get there from here.
The home soon like lightning, we soon will be riding my shiny black bears.
Regular listeners may remember Richard Heimberg from the series On the End of the Age of Oil. He returns to the program, and in discussion with Mike McCormick, addresses energy and the future of industrial society.
We are talking with Richard Heimberg, author of The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. Richard, thank you for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Mike.
Let me start out and ask if you could give us a brief bio of yourself.
Yeah. I'm a journalist. I publish a monthly newsletter that's been in publication for 11 years now. And I've written 5 books, of which this is my most recent. And I also teach human ecology at New College of California in Santa Rosa.
And what was the motivation in writing your current book?
In teaching ecology for a number of years, I've been impressed with the role of energy, first of all, in ecosystems, because ecosystems are kind of the Earth's energy processing devices. Green plants take energy from the sun and turn it into carbohydrates, and animals eat the plants, and other animals eat the animals, and, you know, it's a food web that is basically taking solar energy and using it in as many creative ways as nature can imagine. Human societies operate kind of the same way, taking plant material and people eating plants or eating other animals and so on. But human societies also have other ways of using energy that other species can't, like we've been using fire for the last several hundred thousand years to enlarge the carrying capacity of our environments in various ways. But over the last 200 years, we found ways of using energy that are even more creative than that. We've discovered fossil fuels and built industrialism through that and enlarged the carrying capacity of our planet by over 600%. There were only about 1 billion of us in 1800, and there are over 6 billion of us now. And that's just an amazingly rapid rate of population increase. Looking at it as an ecologist, I'd say that's a population bloom. You know, you can imagine introducing some microorganisms to a vat of grape juice. And the sugar in the grape juice provides plenty of energy for the, let's say, yeast to grow. And so the number of yeast in the vat of grape juice will rapidly proliferate until, of course, they smother themselves with their own waste products, namely alcohol, and turn the grape juice into wine, and all the yeast die out. Well, could we be seeing something similar with industrial society? Human beings have acquired this amazing energy subsidy over the last 200 years, namely fossil fuels, and our numbers have proliferated wildly to take advantage of this temporary subsidy of energy. So is this a classic population bloom situation that will be followed by a die-off once the energy subsidy runs out? That's a question that I ask in the book.
And so what are we looking at in terms of our energy?
Well, we've become overwhelmingly dependent on, as I said earlier, fossil fuels, but largely petroleum, because petroleum is the most energy-dense energy resource that we've ever come across. It's far more convenient than coal. It's easier to get out of the ground. It's cheaper per BTU. So we have tended to use petroleum for the most crucial aspects of industrialism, namely transportation and agriculture. In agriculture, for example, we've used oil to replace muscle power, human muscle power and animal muscle power, which has enlarged our ability to produce food and, again, thereby increasing the human carrying capacity of our environment. Big question is how much oil is out there. Can we continue to support this same way of life indefinitely? Well, of course, we all know that the oil is going to run out sooner or later. When I began researching the book, I started looking into the work of independent and retired petroleum geologists, because I thought those are the people who would, you know, have the least economic stake in this and be able to give us the most accurate information. And I very quickly realized that these people are desperately trying to get out a message that is a message that most of us aren't hearing. That is that petroleum production is going to peak probably within the next 2 to 7 years. And this is going to have a devastating impact on our whole way of life.
We've been kind of hearing about the running out of oil, it seems like, for quite a while, you know. But you feel confident from what you've seen that it's pretty close now.
Well, the idea of running out of oil actually is, it's not exactly accurate, because we probably won't run out of oil. 100 years from now, even 200 years from now, we'll still be getting oil out of the ground. The question is, what will be the rate at which we can extract oil? We tend to have a kind of mental metaphor that we use in thinking about oil of the gas tank in our car. But the gas tank in your car is just this nice reservoir that's made to be easily accessed. Once you fill it up, your car runs fine. When it's half empty, the car runs fine. When you have only a 16th of a tank, the car is running still perfectly. You only notice a problem when the car actually runs out of gas. But with oil in the ground, it's a very different story. It's not just some big spherical tank that we're tapping into. There are all, you know, thousands of reservoirs, some large, some small, many of them in porous rock, many of them in kind of long, snaky, shallow reservoirs that have to be mapped over time and so on. So as petroleum geologists have found over time, there tends to be a sort of bell-shaped curve in petroleum production from any given reservoir. This is dictated by the physics of the process. The stuff that you find first is the easiest to extract, typically. You know, you're getting oil that's under pressure and gushes out of the ground. You know, you don't even have to pump it. But then later on in the process, you're getting the stuff that's maybe further out and have to drill deeper to get it, maybe is lower quality. Instead of being light, sweet crude, it's the heavy, sour crude and so on. So the first half of production is the easy part. But then when you've got about half of the oil out of the ground, the process becomes more difficult, more energy intensive, more expensive, and the quality of the product that you're getting out of the ground is not as good. So this bell-shaped curve sort of determines production, not only regionally, but also globally. And we have almost reached the halfway point globally. We've gotten most of the easy stuff out of the ground. Nature probably gave us about 2 trillion barrels of oil to start with. And we've extracted about 950 billion barrels over the last 150 years. So if we were going to think about it in terms of when we're going to run out, well, we could say, well, how fast are we extracting it now? Well, about 25 billion barrels a year. And there's a billion barrels left, divide a trillion by 25 billion, and you get 40 years. So you could say, well, we'll run out in 40 years. But see, that's not a helpful way of thinking about it. A better way of thinking about it is, when will we reach the peak in production? When will we reach the top of that bell curve? Again, the best estimates are something like 2 to 7 years. And that's based not on crystal ball prognostication, but it's based on the history of production so far in country after country. Because each country has its own discovery curve and its own production curve. And typically the discovery curve looks a lot like the production curve, only it's about 30 years earlier. In other words, you have to find the resource before you can extract it. Here in the U.S., most of the discoveries were made in the 1920s and 1930s. So discovery peaked in the U.S. in the 1930s, but production didn't peak until 40 years later in 1970. If we look at what happened in the U.S., it's like a template for what's going to happen elsewhere in the world. The U.S. was the most explored region of the planet. There have been more oil wells dug in the U.S. or drilled in the U.S. than in the rest of the world put together. So as goes the U.S., so will go every other country. And we can look at Libya, for example, big oil discoveries in the 1950s in Libya. And then by 1970, Libya's oil production peaked. Nigeria, Soviet Union, on and on. There are about 20 countries where we can see very clearly when discovery peaked and when production peaked. And that's already in the past. We're talking about history as much as projections or predictions.
And a lot of this is coming from people who had been in the industry, who know firsthand what's going on.
Yeah.
But from our leaders, we're not hearing too much about this.
I know. It's scandalous. I mean, this should be on the front page of every paper every day, because we're talking about the future of our entire way of life. Dick Cheney says that the American way of life is not negotiable. Well, excuse me, you know, we're not negotiating with another country here. We're negotiating with nature. And nature has certain laws. There's a bumper sticker that I really like that's put out by Earth First. It says, "Nature bats last." And, you know, that's basically true. We've got a spherical planet here. And there's only so much stuff that nature left us. So if the oil is going to run out, if oil production is going to peak relatively soon, what are we going to substitute for that? Now, most of the free market economists who talk about oil say, well, you know, the market will take care of it. As soon as oil starts to become scarce and more expensive, then that will make the alternatives more attractive. Then we'll invest in whatever, you know, nuclear or hydrogen fuel cells or solar or wind or whatever. But that completely overlooks the fact that energy infrastructures have to be built. It takes time and investment to do that. We didn't accomplish the Industrial Revolution overnight. And all of this infrastructure that we built with the Industrial Revolution was built to operate on fossil fuels. That's 150 years of investment and invention and work to build our present infrastructure. Look at the interstate highway system. Hundreds of billions of dollars invested to produce this amazing network of highways to operate cars that run on gasoline. And those highways were built with asphalt, and they're repaired with asphalt, which comes from oil. So this whole transportation system that we've built is built for oil and built with oil. Now, can we overnight transform that to operate on some other resource? No, it's going to take decades. So waiting for the market signal to tell us that we should be using some alternative is asinine. I'm sorry. It's crazy, because that puts us in the bind of, you know, needing the alternative when the alternative is still 40 years away. We should have been beginning to invest in alternatives 30 years ago, when the first oil shock happened in 1973, or after the U.S. oil production peaked in 1970. Instead, we said, oh, well, no problem. We'll just import the stuff from someplace else. And the problem is that we're going to run out of other places to import it from. Sure, Saudi Arabia has 246 billion barrels of oil in its reserves right now, and Iraq, now that we have brought Iraq under our sphere of influence, has another 112 billion barrels. But, you know, those countries may have a lot of oil now, but their own production profile is going to peak at some point. Iraq probably around 2009, 2010. Saudi Arabia around 2015 or 2017. Globally, oil is going to peak between 2005 and 2010. So we don't have a lot of lead time here to make the transition.
Talk a bit about some of the current known alternative energy sources.
Yeah.
And are those viable if we just crank it up on production of them?
Right. Yeah, very important subject. There are many alternatives, and we should be turning to them. We should be investing in them. Some are more attractive than others. Let me take a couple of the less attractive ones first. Nuclear. The nuclear industry is positioning itself for a major resurgence right now. There's a big PR campaign that's just winding up. that the nuclear industry is investing in heavily. There haven't been any new nuclear plants built for the last 25 years or so, and for good reason. People realized that nuclear was dangerous and expensive. Dangerous because we don't know what to do with the nuclear waste, and nuclear plants are inherently dangerous because there's always the possibility of human error or technical error, which could result in the release of radioactivity. And we've already seen that in a number of instances. The nuclear industry is now painting itself as green. It's saying that there's no carbon emissions from nuclear, which actually is not true, because building nuclear plants and mining and processing nuclear fuel is highly polluting in terms of carbon. And the dangers of nuclear plants and the problem of radioactive waste storage have not been solved in the intervening years. They're as much a problem now as they were 30 years ago. Also, the energy profitability of nuclear power is very low. It takes energy to get energy. And if you take the amount of energy required to build a nuclear plant, mine and process the fuel, transport the fuel, operate the plant, and then decommission the plant and store the fuel, the spent fuel, if you add up all of the energy costs in that process, you end up with an energy profit ratio from nuclear energy that's very, very low, something like 3 or 4 to 1, as opposed to the historical energy profit ratio of petroleum, which is more on the range of 100 to 1. So we're looking at a much lower energy society, with energy being much, much more expensive if we turn to nuclear. Let's just take nuclear off the table for the time being and look at the other alternatives. How about hydroelectric power? Very good, very high energy profit ratio. The problem is there's not much room for increase of development there. Most of the rivers that can be dammed, at least in North America, already have been. And there are big ecological problems with dams. Most ecologists that I know would prefer to see the dams dynamited and taken out rather than have more of them built. So there's not much room for growth there. Wind actually is very good. Has a fairly high energy profit ratio of something like 15 to 1. And there are a lot of technical advances going on in wind power, and there's a lot of room for growth in wind energy. Now, can wind make up for oil as oil starts to decrease in supply? Only with huge investments. If we were to invest tens, possibly hundreds of billions of dollars a year in wind, we could possibly make up for the shortfalls. But nobody's contemplating those investments right now. Something similar with solar. Solar has a pretty low energy profit ratio, but there are a lot of technical advances going on in solar right now, which could make it much cheaper in the future. And it's really worth investing more in research and development in solar energy. We should be doing that. Right now, how much energy are we getting from solar and wind total in the U.S. energy economy? Not 5%, not 3%, not 1%, not even a tenth of 1%. It's something like 0.003% of our total energy right now is coming from wind and solar. So in order to make up for what we're going to be losing from oil, we need to invest heavily in these renewable alternatives. Basically, that's what we've got. Hydrogen people talk about as an answer to our energy problems, but it's not really, because it's all hydrogen does is provide an energy carrier. Hydrogen is not an energy source, it's an energy storage medium. You have to make the hydrogen, and right now almost all hydrogen is being made from fossil fuels, from natural gas, even from gasoline. It takes more energy to make the hydrogen than the hydrogen will have. You can make hydrogen with electricity, and this is one of the big selling points that the nuclear industry is using, that we're going to need a new fuel. As oil goes away, hydrogen can supply that fuel source, and we can make the hydrogen from water using electricity, but we don't have enough electricity from solar and wind, so we need more nuclear plants to provide the electricity to make the hydrogen. But again, hydrogen is an energy loser right off the bat. It takes more energy in the form of electricity to make the hydrogen than the hydrogen will have once we send it through a fuel cell or burn it in an internal combustion engine. So hydrogen, yes, will have some applications, niche applications, and I believe that we should be looking into some research on hydrogen as a fuel. But to look at it as a panacea, as a savior for industrial society, is extremely unrealistic. And I think right now what we're seeing is a lot of hype from the coal and nuclear industries that has absolutely nothing to do with our realistic energy future. So if you look at this whole suite of possibilities that includes geothermal, wave energy, tidal energy, as well as all the ones we've been discussing earlier, what you end up with is a much more diversified energy future. We'll be relying on a much wider variety of sources in the future than we are right now. But we'll be looking at energy that's more expensive, and there will be less of it available to operate our industrial societies. So we have to rethink basically how we do everything to use less electrical energy and to use less in the way of transportation fuels.
Yeah, conservation has always been a big thing that hasn't got a lot of focus placed upon it. I mean,
right.
The local energy companies will talk about it, and a big deal to them would be like 10% would be something significant there. If we were to do, let's say, the equivalent of a Manhattan-type project for developing these new energies, putting that amount of thought energy behind solar and wind and everything, and let's say, like, cut our military budget in half and allocate that towards energy.
Great idea.
Would that work, do you think?
Well, it depends on what you mean by would it work. Would it enable us to maintain our present way of life? Probably not. Would it enable us to make a livable transition from our current energy-intensive way of life to another way of life that would be fulfilling, that would enable us to survive, that would enable our children and grandchildren to survive? Yes. If that's what you mean by would it work, yes, it would. And that's what we should be doing. Our current course of action, which is to just simply, you know, use the military to take over existing petroleum supplies and use them till they're gone, I'm afraid that's not going to enable either our present way of life to survive very long, or neither will it likely enable future generations to survive in any form. I think that's imperiling the future existence of human life on the planet Earth.
So if you were put in charge of our energy policies today, what would you immediately implement?
First policy would be use much less. If I were king of the world, I would find some way to take over the advertising industry, first of all. Because right now what the advertising industry does is take billions of dollars a year and use it to give people around the world the message that we need to use more, consume more, and your life is worth nothing unless you have lots of cheap consumer stuff. And that's a suicidal message. Because, again, we live on a spherical planet, and there's only so much stuff here. There's so many basic raw materials, and there's only so much energy available to transform those materials. So encouraging population growth and encouraging consumption is a suicidal path. So what we need to be doing is encouraging population reduction and encouraging a reduction in usage of energy and materials. So I think the first step in that would be reversing that advertising image. And I think that could be done very effectively. You know, the Industrial Revolution has been horrific in a lot of ways. It's destroyed human communities. It's meant the loss of all kinds of skills that people used to have, skills in supporting themselves off the land and doing things with their hands that were worthwhile and that made people feel self-sufficient and competent. Nowadays, what do people know how to do? We know how to push buttons and operate machines. And all of those machines are going to be obsolete in 5 or 10 years. So I think the advertising message could be put out, and I think it would be very effective, that by using less and moving producers and consumers back closer together, reversing the movie of globalization, running that in reverse, and strengthening local communities, we could have a much more fulfilling way of life, a happier way of life, psychologically and socially a more integrated way of life. If that message were put out there and if we had real political leadership to lead the way, I think we could make this transition in a coordinated way, in a way that would not only be preserving human life, but also life of other species. Just yesterday, well, I know this show's being taped, May 15th, the Seattle Times ran a front-page story on the fact that 90% of the fisheries around the globe are depleted. So, you know, if it's not oil, what's it going to be? What will be the next resource that we'll run out of? Fish, fresh water, topsoil. There's a long list. So nature is really tapping us on the shoulder here and saying, look, you have to change your ways. So here's the opportunity to start with fossil fuels right now. It's not just a moral choice. It's not saying, well, to save the whales and to save the dolphins, we'll cut back a little bit. We're talking about survival here. Fundamentally, the choice that we have to make is between perpetual war and ultimate species suicide on one hand, or cutting back, changing our way of life, and becoming more sensible on the other. If it's put in those terms, if the advertising message is put out that way, I think the vast majority of people are going to say, yeah, okay, let's pull together, like we did in World War II. Sure, we had energy rationing, we had gasoline rationing in World War II. People had to grow victory gardens. They couldn't just go out and shop for nylons and consumer products the way they might have wanted to, but they realized that they were pulling together for their common good and for their common survival. And all of the advertising industry pulled together during World War II to get that message out and to help people undertake those hard choices, personal choices, and it worked. So I know it can work in the future if we have the political will to make it happen. Now, what's likely to happen over the short term is that we will have more energy shortages, starting probably this year, 2003, certainly in 2004, and it's not going to be oil that will hit us first, but natural gas. Everyone in the natural gas industry is sounding the alarm right now. They're telling us, look, we just can't find enough of the stuff. They're finding smaller wells on average. The typical natural gas well in North America is 60% depleted in the first year, which means that the industry is on a treadmill, and they're having to run faster and faster on that treadmill just to stay even with production. The U.S. is importing 17 or 18% of its natural gas right now from Canada. I was just in Canada last week, and the Canadians are not very happy about that because they're exporting 60% of what they produce to the U.S., and they're not able to find as much as they need to keep up production, and they're starting to worry. Well, you know, they need natural gas themselves to heat their houses, and, you know, Canada is a kind of a dark, cold country. They're starting to wonder if they made a mistake in signing NAFTA, which basically compels them to sell 60% of their natural gas to the U.S., whether they want to or not. So this coming summer of 2003, we're looking at warmer than normal temperatures are being forecast, which means more air conditioners online, more demand for electricity, and a lot of our electricity is being produced by natural gas now. Also, a number of nuclear power plants are going to be offline for maintenance. So we may be seeing brownouts and blackouts this summer as a result of true natural gas shortages. Now, it'll be interesting to see how this is portrayed in the press, whether it would be portrayed as another political problem, as another problem of, Enron crony capitalism, or whether we're actually told the truth this time, that we're in fact just running out of the stuff, that there just isn't enough natural gas available to supply our demand.
What's the message you would like to leave our listeners with?
Well, the message that I would like to leave is that we're faced with probably the biggest challenge in the history of our species. There are 6.3 billion of us on the planet right now. There were fewer than a billion of us when we first discovered fossil fuels. We've added 5 billion to our population on the basis of this non-renewable energy supply. We've used transportation, we've used agricultural technical advances to support this added population load. And we're faced with a crisis because those resources are going to start becoming more scarce and expensive very soon. This is very serious business. Our lives and the lives of our children and grandchildren depend on our making the right choice. We need to see what's at stake here, and we need to get the information out to our friends and colleagues. We need to get the information out also to corporations and to the government and let them know how we feel about this. Here in the U.S., things look pretty bleak because we have an administration in power that is going pell-mell, gung-ho, down what I see as precisely the wrong avenue, just saying, you know, intensify extraction and use the military to commandeer remaining resources and use them till they're gone. Around the world, a very different view prevails. And if you look at the world outside the U.S., you get a very different picture. People in Europe, people in the less consuming countries are very concerned about future oil supplies, and they are willing to undertake the kinds of conservation measures and hard choices that we've been talking about. It's not going to be easy for anyone in any country, but certainly outside the U.S., there's much greater awareness of the problem and much greater willingness to respond to it. So I think what we need to do in this country is join hands with people around the world to get this message across to our fellow Americans and to the people in charge of this country, and perhaps a regime change here in the U.S. is part of what needs to happen in order to solve this problem. I would guess that it is. So we are, as I said, faced with a crisis, but we are capable of getting through this. If we work together, if we have the right message, we make the right choices, we could arrive a century from now at a situation far better than what we're facing right now. We could be living in sustainable communities, eating food that's grown safely and organically close to where we live. Our communities could be much richer, more diverse, and more unified than they are now. We could have a way of life that's extremely satisfying, but we'll only get there if we make the right choices now.
All right, we've been talking with Richard Heinberg, author of The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. Richard, how can people get your newsletter?
Well, they can contact me through www.museletter.com. There's a way they can email me through that website also.
Mike McCormick speaking with Richard Heinberg, author of The Party's Over. Given the coming energy scenario that Heinberg spoke about, one can reasonably predict that the ones who will suffer the most are the ones who always do, the ones with little wealth, and that pool is increasing. In spite of the promised unalienability of the right to live, Americans have no economic rights. Our next speaker, Jeff Gates, believes that a capitalist market economy can be redesigned to serve the general welfare. He spoke with Sue Supriano about what he calls shared capitalism.
Jeff Gates is a recovering lawyer and has recently written a book called Democracy at Risk, Rescuing Main Street from Wall Street, a Populist Vision for the 21st Century. Tell me a little bit about yourself, or tell us, the audience, a little bit about yourself.
I'm a former counsel to the Senate Finance Committee. I spent 7 years there in the 1980s throughout Reaganomics. My boss and mentor there was a fellow named Russell Long from Louisiana, who's the son of sort of well-known populist Huey Long from the 1930s. And my job there was to devise ways to try to expand wealth without redistributing wealth. How do you make capitalists of people who don't have any capital? I've since worked in about 35 countries on that mission. And I've been working at this, I guess, for about 30 years as an attorney, as an investment banker, as a consultant to foreign governments, and now as an author. Democracy at Risk was used in the year 2000 by Ralph Nader to brand the Green Party, the party of the new populism. It was a sequel to a book that came out in 1998 called The Ownership Solution Toward a Shared Capitalism for the 21st Century. And that's why I call my nonprofit the Shared Capitalism Institute, which has a website by that name.
Actually, my impression of capitalism is that it's built on the exploitation of other people.
Well, if you keep it real simple, I mean, capital is a funny sort of instrument. The reason we have finance generally is to enable us to have something today and pay for it tomorrow. And you find that the first committee founded by the Congress was, of course, the Finance Committee, one of the first, because you had to finance the country. So indeed, capitalism is kind of built into the notion of how do you manage to have something today that you know you could indeed manage to pay for in the future. And the real challenge is it's not so much that there's a problem with capitalism, is that there's just too few capitalists, too few people who cut in on the system. And that's not some grand conspiracy, although some days I think there might be one. But capitalism is not designed to create capitalists. It's designed to finance capital. And it could do both. Having written federal tax law for 7 years, guaranteed we could have written the laws so that a great group of Americans, a broad group of Americans, were sharing in the prosperity. We could have written them as we did to ensure that very few people shared in that prosperity. And the choice between those two is what I talk about, and it seems to me a genuinely robust and sustainable capitalism or free enterprise democracy, whatever you want to call it, must be designed to be widely inclusive, and that's my mission.
Well, isn't that the nature of capitalism to keep consolidating? I mean, it seems like, it's you need other people to exploit, and...
Yeah. And again, to use the term capitalism is such a loaded word anyway. The word was invented by Karl Marx to describe a system that he absolutely abhorred. So you start off with a deficit, and indeed from my left-of-center friends, I take a lot of abuse for even thinking about using the term, and I may well change it. But it was intended to be provocative. It's intended to confound the left and confuse the right or vice versa. And to say, look, we have a system now that is capitalist. Let's get real about it. The question is, how do you transform it into something that is sustainable, socially just, and, you know, at least sane? And I think we could agree that the current system is not sane, in large part because it does ensure a ever-broadening gap between rich and poor, both as to wealth and income.
Which translates to power.
Well, yeah, it does. Because you'll find, for example, that 71 of the top 400 contributors to both political parties are money managers and stockbrokers now. Five of the top 10 zip codes for both political parties run up the Upper East Side of Manhattan, which is the home to the money management and media elite, right? So the notion that you can design a system to be inclusive, which you can, or to be exclusive, which you can, is the point of my work. And capitalism, again, it's not designed to create capitalists. It's simply designed to finance the next generation of capital. And its current design will ensure that that next generation is owned by the current owners. But that is a design flaw. I don't think it's a systemic flaw. It's a choice we've made politically. And we could have made another choice. It's just that, you know, the system we have is based on full employment. People are not asking to own. They're asking to have a job. And that, to me, is unfathomable. We're well beyond the Industrial Revolution, well into an information revolution, and we're still pretending that the goal of a modern economy is to put people to work. I thought the goal of the modern economy was to put people out of work. And you could do that if you crafted the system so that a broad base of people actually own things.
Say how you would do it.
Well, there's no one right way to do it. I mean, I wrote federal tax law for 7 years, so there's a whole smorgasbord of ways you could do it there. And we have many of them. One of the mechanisms is called an employee stock ownership plan, called an ESOP. The fundamental notion is productive assets can pay for themselves. You don't have to pay for them out of the savings of your labor. Rich people know that. They borrow money and let the productive assets repay the debt. That's how you get rich.
What does that mean?
Well, for example, if you they call them leverage buyouts. I was an investment banker for a while. We'd go out and borrow large amounts of money to buy companies, American Standard being one. It was a $3 billion purchase. We raised about $270 million in equity and actual cash and borrowed the rest. So it was leveraged about 11 to 1. The projections were that company could generate the earnings sufficient to retire that debt and allow us to buy that entire company. Which was done. So we know that capital pays for itself over time. What we continue to pretend is that people should buy capital with their earnings from their labor. So the new sort of motto, instead of let them eat cake, the new motto is let them buy stock. After all, it's a free market. Just go out and buy some. You know, so it's not a robust model. It is extraordinarily exclusive. To give you an idea, the wealth of the Forbes 400 richest Americans. From 1998 to the year 2000, their wealth grew, on average, $1.9 million per day. That's $240,000 per eight-hour workday. Or if you're out there working for the minimum wage, that's 46,602 times the minimum wage. So yes, those who are suspicious of capitalism are rightly suspicious of it as it's currently designed. And that doesn't mean it can't be designed to do otherwise. We've not done a good job of getting rid of capitalism. The systems that tried to do it were miserable. They got rid of the robber barons and got the robber bureaucrats. So the question is, how do you tame it? How do you make it work?
Mm-hmm. How do you? Jeff Gates.
Well, I think the way you do it is you make it inclusive. Keep in mind, we finance each year in the U.S. economy about $1,000 billion in new plant and equipment, new buildings, new machinery, new equipment, that sort of thing, plus about another $2,000 to $2,500 billion in mergers and acquisitions, you know, companies acquiring and being sold, that sort of thing. We're incredibly financially sophisticated in this country. We have absolutely the financial skills to create broad-based shared prosperity in this country and in every country worldwide. There's no doubt in my mind about it. We know every financial technique that's needed. It'd be nice to have some more, but we absolutely know how to create broad-based shared prosperity. Instead, we made a political choice by, I say, both of these parties, both the Demopubs and the Republicrats, to make this an extraordinary exclusive system. The money that goes then from Wall Street goes right back into their campaign coffers, and you get this over and over again.
I guess that the main point is the gaps, the unfairness of the system, really, the way it is now.
Well, and it's the sustainability of it. I mean, please don't be deceived to think that the current administration happens to be Republican this time, but it could have been just as well the Clinton-Gore administration. They bill themselves as conservatives. They're anything but conservatives. I'm a great believer in markets, and markets are supposed to respond to people. That's a fiction. They don't respond to people. They respond to people with money. Mm-hmm. If you concentrate income, as we have done, the income of the top 1% is now greater than the combined income of the 100 million poorest Americans. If you concentrate income, you've undermined markets. That's not a conservative notion. If you're a genuine conservative, you believe in private property. But private property depends for its legitimacy on its lack of exclusivity. If you make it very exclusive, as we've done, you've actually undermined private property. I'm telling you, these are not conservatives. Genuine conservatives believe in fiscal foresight. Well, imagine a situation knowing full well that we had 76 million baby boomers, I'm age 57, barreling toward retirement with votes, a hugely robust voting block of seniors. Imagine allowing them to imagine endorsing a policy environment that enabled those people to reach this age and to be this undercapitalized, moving into retirement and dependent on Social Security. What a monstrous system, and anything but conservative. So if any of this group ever tries to persuade you that they're conservative, ask them a simple question. What is it that you intend to conserve? And if you find anything, please call Sue and let her know, and we'll have another interview on that issue.
Well, so many things are not what they seem to be, and the whole system is so fraught with corruption. I mean, it's just layers and layers of corruption. I guess we should stick to the solutions here, because many people understand about the problems, or maybe they don't really understand. I don't know, but you could address that, Jeff Gates, if you will.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, working in, you know, several dozen countries abroad, you try to reduce this to a simple formula. And one formula is very easy. Where the cash flows, ownership grows. If you show me a revenue stream, guaranteed somebody's going to become an owner of that in some fashion. So, for example, it looked as though Walmart was a good investment to people because in 1979 it had about $1 billion in sales. By the year 2002, it had $240 billion in sales. They've just told analysts within the last few months that they intend to double that by the year 2007. Their CEO says he can probably triple that within the next 10 years. So now keep in mind, you have one family in Arkansas that already has about $100 to $120 billion, meaning the heirs of Sam Walton, the founder. So now you have seniors saying, gee, we need help with prescription drugs. Why? Because we have the most extraordinary distribution or concentration of both wealth and income that we've had since 1929 right now in this country. So people need help with prescription drugs.
And they're cutting all the safety net, of course, what there was.
Well, what part of the safety net is the notion of, well, if you're older and you can't afford to take care of yourself, that the, you know, democracy enables you to vote in a system that so that you're not required to be abjectly poor and on the streets. So seniors are already saying, this is before the baby boomers begin to retire, we need help with prescription drugs. So we'll enact some sort of law. It will have something to do with Medicare that will say, okay, we're going to help you out. Now, that will be a tax on people's jobs. In an economy where the national economic policy is full employment, we're going to tax employment in order to provide Medicare prescription drugs. Now, where do you think people are going to buy those prescription drugs? Walmart already has 2,500 pharmacies. They could well have 8,000 to 10,000 pharmacies by the time the baby boomers reach retirement. So the system is profoundly dysfunctional for a very simple reason. It's absolutely indifferent as to the patterns of wealth and income. The current system is very simple. It's a mechanistic, Newtonian sort of system. It says when you send all your money to Wall Street and you say maximize financial returns and just trust us, everything else is going to work out fine. So you end up with things like Bill Gates in Seattle could become a trillionaire. He could become a quadrillionaire. That's a million billion or a billion million, depending upon how you like your math. And this current crowd of, I don't know what to call them, except sort of ideological nutcases, are indifferent about that. And meanwhile, there's 76 million baby boomers who begin to look around at each other and say, have you got anything to live on in retirement? And they don't. And we're misascribing the problem by saying we got to save Social Security and make it. Well, Social Security is in pretty good shape, is the truth of the matter. But even when it's in good shape, the last time I looked, which was about 1999, it was only paying on average $27.10 a day. So even if it's fully funded, imagine what you're going to have to live on in retirement.
Well, we already see lots of, at least where I live in Berkeley, lots of people and lots of them very old on the streets, and it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah. Well, at some point you wonder if this is by design, and that's a terrible thing to say. But you've got a choice here, I think, and it's not a very happy choice. That either these policymakers are incompetent, because these patterns are well known, these dynamics are well known, how this system works, or they're complicit. So you got your choice: either they're clueless or corrupt. And I would say that is not a great criteria for high office. So we know how capitalism finances itself. We know it's done within a very closed system. It's not designed to create capitalists. It's designed to finance capital. It's designed to minimize cost. And the primary cost that enterprises can control is their labor cost. And yet we've left the bulk of Americans dependent for their livelihood on employment, which means their labor. And then we've gone with globalization, this current brand of globalization, and basically internationalized or globalized labor markets. Now, the notion that you can compete with against somebody being paid $5 a week in China is nonsense. Yet walk down the aisles of Walmart and try to find me something made in America. So this is not a logical system. It's sort of a nutcase ideology system, and it's a system that tends to dominate people with an ideology that's dysfunctional.
But I also often wonder, you know, all this economic so-called expansion, that, I mean, what are they going to do when they run out of people to buy it? I mean, there have to be people to buy these things, right? And it seems, I don't, you know, don't have any deep understanding of economics, but that one constantly puzzles me, and I never hear anybody address it.
No, it's a great question, and it's like one of those intuitive common sense questions that people rightly raise. So your sophistication is much better than most of the economists I've dealt with for the last 30 years. What you have when you have if you have a physical capacity to produce, and people have physical needs that they would like to have met with that physical capacity, if you have a mismatch of the two, by definition, you've got a failure of systems design. And in economics, they call it an overcapacity recession, meaning you got enormous capacity, you know, manufacturing plants standing idle, and people over there not able to work because they're not employed. It is this imbalance of allowing wealth and income to be highly concentrated. But I mean, just imagine in the late 70s, the gap between the top 20% of the U.S. and the bottom 20% was 9-1 on an income basis. It's now 15-1. The bottom most 20% of Americans now get about 3.6% of the national income. The top 20% now takes about half. So you end up with the top 20% are doing okay. The top 5% are, you know, swimming in cash. The top 1%, I mean, the sales of super luxury yachts 150 feet or longer are doing just fine. Daimler Chrysler launched their Maybach sedan in Orange County on July 4th of last year. The sticker price is $300,000. They anticipate brisk sales in Orange County.
Yeah, well, it's really not right. I'll tell you that. That is for sure. And it seems, like you said, it's not sustainable, and it can't continue on. So what do we do? I mean, I'd like to spend the rest of the program on that.
Yeah, sure. It's not useful to, you know, so whine and complain about these things without having practical solutions, and that's what I write books about. They have to be financially practical, economically workable. And a lot of it has to do with policy itself. I mean, imagine, for example, if the national economic policy was not just widespread employment of our labor resources, but also widespread ownership of our capital resources. Now, is that Democrat, Republican, or Reform Party, you know, or Green? It's like a non-ideological issue.
Well, I don't know. You say it's non-ideological, but I don't know how that's going to happen. It sounds like a good idea, but...
Well, what could be more conservative than a property-owning middle class? I mean, if I were a Republican running in Berkeley, I might beat any Democrat there. Say, I'm going to turn you into an owner. Imagine somebody responding to say, no, I don't want you to do that. How do you do that? Every government contract that goes out of the United States, goes out of Washington, you condition on making sure that it's partly, that those companies are partly employee-owned, perhaps partly also owned by their suppliers. They're transporters, they're distributors. You make sure that you're not indifferent about those ownership patterns. Every time you let out a license for anything, particularly broadcasting, you make sure that ownership is embedded in the communities they serve. Anytime you allow public, private access to public resources, whether it's mining, timber, anything like that, you say, we're not allowing this out unless those result in broad-based ownership. Any place that you see public policy impacting finance, which is every place, you no longer remain indifferent about the distributions of wealth and income that come from that. It's not Democrat, it's not Republican, it's not Reform Party or Green, it's just simple common sense. If you're trying to look out there in the future and say, what do we want 20 years from now? What we don't want is what we're almost certainly going to have unless we have a dramatic change, which is says we want a genuinely shared prosperity.
Yeah, right. But so how do we do that? You know, how can the people in the audience, what are they supposed to go do next?
Yeah, the first thing you do is realize you're being lied to by both parties and get angry about it. I mean, I could say anyone who's not outraged is out to lunch at this point. Anyone who's not profoundly saddened at the foregone opportunities is profoundly ill-informed. We have, from the Cold War through now budgeted through 2009, we will spend $21.1 trillion on the Pentagon. If you're feeling any more secure, you're nuts. So we know that the only way to possibly secure this country now, you can't secure an open society. The only way you can get security is if you want peace, you've got to work for justice. So we know that we can do a shared prosperity worldwide. We know we can deploy what I call a prosperity corps to go alongside a peace corps to go out and do that worldwide. We absolutely have the financial technologies and the green technologies to do that. My sense of it is there's a lot of Americans will be absolutely inspired to take on that kind of a mission to say we're gonna eradicate our enemy. Our enemy is not terrorist. Our enemy is poverty, the context out of which that comes. We absolutely know how to do that. So you need to insist that the agenda that makes sense is pursued. You need to be asked the tough questions of anyone who's running for public office because they're not getting the right questions. They don't have the questions properly framed, so we're getting lousy answers. Ask them, who's going to own all those defense plants that we're funding? Who's going to own all those defense contracts you're giving out? What's going to happen to the oil that's being taken out of Alaska if you're going to allow that to happen? Who's going to get rich off that? Start asking the harder questions and insist that you be included in the system and with something other than simply being an employee or a worker. And that's where the progressive movement has gone way off the track. They're trying to negotiate everything for everyone from the status of a worker. Please get over it.
Well, of course, this is totally political. And as you were saying, Jeff Gates, the corporations with the money give lots of money to both parties. And so the politicians are pretty much bought.
Keep in mind that these politicians that you're saying are being bought by the corporations, they're being bought on your behalf. When you get up in the morning and look at yourself in the mirror, if you have a 401k plan, you're probably trying to chase the best possible financial return you can. And so you basically are signaling that corporation to say, why don't you clear the decks and let me do everything I can to maximize my returns, pay minimum wage, and devastate the environment, because after all, my 401k plan, I got to have that 4.8% return. I can't get by on 4.2. The only enemy out there is ourselves. There is no other out there. And so recognize that and organize around that kind of a theme. Well, one of the most positive things evolving now is, particularly at the Planet Work conference, is the notion of alternative currencies, community currencies, time dollars, local currencies that can match up local capacities with local needs, so that you begin to wean yourself off this sort of Federal Reserve note currency, where the only way that you have any money to spend is by exchanging your labor in the marketplace. So again, there's not one answer to these things, because the problem is very diverse, it's very widespread, and it's embedded in the model itself. So you're finding what I write books about, Democracy at Risk and the Ownership Solution, is how you take an overlay of many of these different solutions and put them in place, because that's the only way we're going to pull ourselves out of this.
Are you organizing?
Oh, absolutely. This is the time to do it. We're in extraordinarily critical times, and anyone not organizing has now become a part of the problem.
Okay, and I'll remind people of your book, Jeff Gates. It's Democracy at Risk, Rescuing Main Street from Wall Street, a Populist Vision for the 21st Century. And thank you very much for this interview, Jeff Gates.
Thank you, Sue. I enjoyed it.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. Though I haven't read Gates' book and can't fairly comment on his specific remedies, I'm tempted to suggest that his proposed economy where workers are owners no longer meets the definition of capitalism as defined by the creator of the term, the 19th century German social philosopher Karl Marx. So it seems fitting that we should next hear from Professor Michael Leibowitz, a scholar of Marx, on how he defined capitalism and why he considered it antithetical to a good society. The interviewer is Chris Spanos of Vancouver Cooperative Radio.